The library is co-sponsoring this presentation with the Milstein Center for Interreligious Dialogue, so I will keep my words very brief. I just want to say that Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum is memorialized in the library of the Jewish Theological Seminary, thanks to your generosity. Just a few years before we undertook the project, which is about to come to fruition on the other side of what used to be a courtyard and is now a courtyard and atrium, we built a digitization studio in memory of Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum. And it was a very, very active place. Again, thanks to your generosity, we were able to digitize many important manuscripts and other rare materials. And our commitment to that remains strong. And so when we closed down, there are a lot of things relating to our rare materials that we could not do. But we refused to give up on our digitization. And so at our site where we store all of our rare materials, upstate New York, we rented an additional room, and we have continued to do digitization of rare materials there almost the entire time that we've been without a library. With the partnership of and the support of the National Library of Israel, we've continued that work, and I'm thrilled also to report that with the opening of this new building, that same digitization studio with the same dedicatory plaque that we put up at that time will be there. Marvelously, the digitization studio and the conservation lab are each within the other, adjacent each to the other. And so we will be able to begin those projects again full scale as soon as we open up, and we're very excited about that. So thank you. Again, this night is devoted to a discussion of the incomparable legacy of Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum and to introduce the book and say a little bit more. I introduce my friend and colleague, Rabbi Bert Vysotsky.
Thank you, David. So thank you. Welcome, everyone, and welcome all of you who will be listening to this as a podcast. You're going to have a career as a podcaster. I particularly want to welcome Leonard Polonsky. He's a cheerleader for Georgette, and we're always delighted to have you here and recognize the presence of the Chancellor and Vice Chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, Arnie Eisen and Mark Gary, and my colleague from downtown, Adrian Levine. So it's nice that we have an audience here who will appreciate. I was telling Georgette that back in the day, 45 years ago when I was a rabbinical student, this was the synagogue on Shabbat morning for the seminary synagogue. And on Arnie's side of the aisle was where the men sat, and on Georgette's side of the aisle is where the women sat. And that had been the case for many, many years. Professor Lieberman, Professor Finkelstein, the row behind them, they allowed Heschel to sit. But I'm equally certain that just as I had fear and trembling standing up to give my senior sermon, that Mark also had to endure that experience, a bit of a baptism, I don't know if that's the right word, trial by fire. I want to introduce Georgette, and I'm going to do something I don't usually do, which is read a little bit from her online CV, because it's Georgette. She is the president of the Tannenbaum Center for Interreligious Understanding, a sociologist by training, and she has spent the last 25 years advancing interreligious relations. She founded the Tannenbaum Center in 1992 to combat religious prejudice, and currently is in 2013, and ongoing, unfortunately, is the founder of the Multi-Faith Alliance for Syrian Refugees. Georgette mobilizes support for alleviating the suffering of Syria's war victims. All you have to do is open the paper. What you don't see in the headlines and have to read deep between the lines is that Georgette is there, literally bringing millions of dollars of aid to Syrian refugees, and doing it in conjunction with the State of Israel. So It's good for the Syrian refugees. It's also good for the Jews. Georgette is a founding board member of Global Covenant Partners and a participant in the Global Covenant of Religions, which is an international group of interfaith leaders working to delegitimize the use of religion as a justification for violent extremism. And God knows there are a lot of religious actors out there spewing hate, so we're grateful. Dr. Bennett served in the U.S. State Department Religion and Foreign Policy Group, making recommendations for the Secretary of State on countering religious-based violence. She is an active philanthropist, focusing her charities on activities in conflict resolution and what I guess we still call intergroup relations. I remember very fondly because that was what Louis Finkelstein's Finkelstein Institute, they did intergroup relations. Georgette serves on the board of the Third Way Institute, the Jewish Funders Network. She's an overseer of the International Rescue Committee, and in the United Kingdom, is it still the United Kingdom today? Yes, in England, she serves on the advisory board of the Foundation for Relief and Reconciliation in the Middle East. Georgette has earned a PhD in sociology from NYU, her BA from my daughter's alma mater, Vassar College, and also a degree from the American Bankers Association. She is the author of 4 books herself, over 50 articles. That's the resume. What I want to say is that, and I will get emotional, I've had the privilege of knowing Georgette for quite a number of years, and she is my hero. She's my rabbi. She's one of those people that when you're in a situation that requires you to get up off your lazy behind and get to work, my mantra is, well, it's what Georgette would do. So I guess that makes you my rabbi as well. This also makes Georgette an extraordinary Ezer Kenegdo. She was the perfect partner to the late Rabbi Tannenbaum. Because I work in interreligious dialogue activities quite extensively, there is nothing I do that Mark Tannenbaum didn't light the way for us. So I'm going to let Georgette talk more about that in detail. Her topic tonight is, quote, "Words Matter, Hate, Violence, and Lessons from Another Era." Georgette.
Just make sure this is on and working.
I wish I could have Bert around all the time, because he always makes me feel so good. But I want to make Bert feel good, too. But in a few seconds, I want to make you feel good, because first I want to recognize Arnie Ivan, who really brought an extraordinary vision to the Jewish Theological Seminary. He has had an extraordinary career here, and it's a career that will be memorialized in bricks and mortar, as well as the extraordinary impact that he has had on the direction of the seminary, a direction that I find personally very exciting and that I think Mark would have wholeheartedly endorsed, because it is very outward-facing and relating to the communities that are out there, something that Mark understood very well. Now, you, Bert, even though you were full of praise for me, I want to recognize the extraordinary work that you're doing, both nationally and internationally, and especially the very meaningful outreach that you have done to the Muslim community, because I think it's particularly important that Muslims and Jews make common cause for a whole bunch of reasons, but that's for another lecture. Everything that Mark was known for began here. So the only thing that bothers me about the new campus, Arnie, is that when it's complete, I'm going to lose that feeling about Mark having walked these halls, because these are brand new halls, and he will not have walked them. But everything that he did begin here. It was a voyage for Mark to get to JTS. He did his undergraduate work at Yeshiva University, And when he was sitting in class one day, he found yeshiva to be a very oppressive atmosphere, by the way. And in class one day, his teacher was describing the dots that serve as vowels in Hebrew. And he noticed that Mark was sitting there and seemed not to be paying attention. So he called on him and he said, "Tannenbaum, what did I just do?" To which Tannenbaum replied, "You just made a vowel movement." Mark became a rabbi by default. There was a conflict between his father and his mother. His mother always felt that she needed to prove his orthodox credentials for her family. I mean, never mind that they weren't alive anymore. She still felt that she had to be orthodox enough and produce an orthodox enough son, a rabbi, for the family. His father was much more practical. His father wanted Mark to become a doctor because he said, "Mark, there will always be sick people, so you should be a doctor." So Mark went with his father, but of course with the numerous clauses, it was very difficult to get into medical school then. But he finally did get into medical school with his uncle Max pulling some strings. And the first day at medical school, the students walked into the cadaver room, and Mark turned around and walked right out, and like Lot, never looked back, except Lot did, and his wife turned into a pillar of salt. Nobody turned into a pillar of salt, because Mark never looked back. He just said, "What am I doing here?" So he was very much adrift. You know, what was he going to do? He knew he was never going to be an Orthodox rabbi because he was a real rebel. I mean, he just couldn't get into the whole idea of what is the proper way to boil an egg and what is the impact of that on life. He just couldn't connect with any of that. So one day he happened to be strolling down Broadway and he ran into a friend of his from yeshiva. And that friend was Harold Schulweis. And Harold said to Mark, "You know, I'm going up to JTS to take the admissions test." And Mark said, "I'm coming with you." So that's how he ended up at JTS. And that's how his life finally got on track. He entered JTS in 1946, which also happens to be the year I was born. So those are two momentous things that happened in the same year. It was the Finkelstein era, as Bert said. And the Finkelstein era was really a kind of beginning of an outward-facing Judaism that, like Arnie, believed very much in the importance of reaching out to a broader community. And it was also in the Finkelstein era that media became an important part of reaching out, because a radio show called The Eternal Light was written and produced here at JTS, and Mark became a writer on that show. And that kind of foreshadowed his emphasis on media in terms of his work. Finkelstein had also recruited Heschel to JTS, Abraham Joshua Heschel. And that, too, was a huge turning point for Mark, but a little bit more about that later. Mark absolutely reveled in the intellectually free atmosphere at JTS. In fact, he had a radical socialist classmate who made a habit of buttonholing him in the bathroom and challenging him to prove the existence of God. Now, a dinner conversation, Bert. And they would go on having screaming matches in the bathroom until 3 or 4 in the morning, until finally a visiting novelist, I guess he must have been a novelist in residence or something, would say, "Will you people go to sleep? You are not going to solve that problem here in the John." So that was the kind of atmosphere here at JTS, which he absolutely loved. Then you had the all-star professors, and Heschel is the one with whom Mark connected very, very closely. It was an interesting relationship because Heschel was Mark's mentor here at JTS. But after Mark was ordained, Mark became Heschel's mentor, and he was Heschel's mentor in his life of activism because Heschel was very much a scholar and very much lived in the academy. That was his life. So after Mark was ordained, he didn't immediately become a working rabbi. Maybe he was never a working rabbi, because he was never, except for once in a while, a pulpit rabbi. So he first went into publishing. He went to work for Henry Schumann and Company as an editor. And as an editor at Henry Schumann and Company, he commissioned Heschel's first English language book, The Earth is the Lord's. And he told Henry Schumann, "You absolutely must publish this book." And Mark commissioned an artist to do the wood etchings that were in that book, got Reinhold Niebuhr to review the book, and that, of course, began a lifelong friendship between Heschel and the great Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. He introduced Heschel to Martin Luther King, and in one of your halls here, you have the iconic photograph of Heschel and Martin Luther King in the March on Selma. So he brought Heschel basically into his life of activism, brought him into the civil rights movement, brought him into Vatican Council II, brought him into presidential commissions. So it was a very interesting role reversal, switching the mentor and mentee relationship. But I think an interesting question to ask is, how does the son of Orthodox Jewish immigrants make it his life's mission to build bridges among the great religions? And that's very much Bert's mission as well. So there are two answers to that question in Mark's case. The first answer is that he had an uncle in the Ukraine. His family was from the Ukraine. And this would have been probably in the early 1900s. His uncle happened to be walking down the street after the Easter sermon was just completed in the local church, and all of the congregants were streaming out, and their passions were so inflamed by that Easter sermon that they grabbed the first Jew they could find and forced him into the river Bug till he drowned. So that's one answer to the question of how he became interested in interreligious relations, because it raised for him the question, how can a religion that is such a gospel of love be such a gospel of hate when it comes to the Jews? Then the other answer is his mother. Mark was born in Baltimore. The family lived in an ethnic neighborhood where there were no Jews, but there were lots of Poles and Germans and Italians. And his parents had a grocery store on a corner. And they chose this location for the grocery store in the expectation that one day the streetcar was going to stop there, that there would be a streetcar station. But it never came. So they lived in poverty. The grocery store never really had a lot of customers. But every Christmas, Mark's mother, Sadie, used to pack up baskets for their Catholic neighbors. And Mark wondered, why are we doing this? Because she used to take him by the hand, and every Christmas they would deliver baskets to their Christian neighbors. And his mother said, Mark, in her Yiddish accent, that's because our neighbors can't be without food on their big holiday. We have to take care of them. So it was hate speech that killed Mark's uncle, and it was healing thoughts that drove Mark's mother. So my focus in this talk today is going to be on hate speech. And because Heschel was Mark's mentor here at JTS, let me start with Heschel on the subject of words. In the Hebrew language, bloodshed is the word that denotes both murder and humiliation. And Heschel said, it is better, the Talmud insists, to throw oneself alive into a burning furnace than to humiliate a human being publicly. Another thing that Heschel said was one of the major symptoms of the general crisis existent in our world today is our lack of sensitivity to words. We use words as tools. We forget that words are a repository of the spirit. In fact, today, one of the greatest threats to humanity is hate speech and the weaponization of language. Now, that term did not exist when Mark was pioneering the interreligious work for which he became famous. But it was a concept that he understood very well, and he understood that it was a key weapon in the arsenal for combating hate. He often preached about the inexorable link between verbal violence and physical violence, and it starts with dehumanizing the other with words. And we know what a lot of those words are: kike, spick, towelhead, etc., etc., etc. Words like those empty others of their humanity and reduce them to a caricature that's filled with contempt. And then it becomes a very small thing to swing that hate-filled caricature from a lynching tree, or to shove them into the fires of a Nazi oven, or to shoot them at prayer in a mosque in New Zealand. America is replete with linkages between moral fervor and physical violence, from the pious Puritans who burnt their witches, to the Ku Klux Klan who burnt their crosses, to neo-Nazis who march in Charlottesville complaining Jews will not replace us. And world history is replete with many more examples. One need only look at the roots of the genocides in Bosnia and Rwanda, genocides that began with leaders spewing hate speech. And then there's the politics of the right in the U.S., Western Europe, and the anti-refugee rhetoric that pervades public policy. Think about words like infestation. Think about words like invasion. And ironically, although the core precepts of each of the great religions are rooted in love and peace and respect, it's there that one finds the roots of hate speech. Mark referred to this as group narcissism, the idea that one's own group holds a monopoly on truth. And that group narcissism is grounded in apocalyptic thinking that divides the world into the children of light and the children of darkness. And by virtue of being black or foreign or Jewish or Catholic or Muslim or liberal or gay or whatever despised minority of the moment is there, a person can be branded impure and therefore fair game for bigoted scourges. The link between verbal and physical violence is very clear, and the impact of it on the people we love to hate is very clear. There's been a tremendous rise in hate crimes. There were nearly 7,200 of them in 2017. Hate crimes against the LGBTQ community have nearly doubled. Religion-based crimes, 23% increase, only since 2016. Crimes against Muslims have decreased by 11%, but you need to realize that there was a tremendous surge in hate crimes against Muslims in the years following the 9/11 attacks. Crimes against Jews rose 37%, and in every year since 1991, crimes against Jews and Jewish institutions account for 50 to 80% of all religion-based hate crimes. Now, that's very important, hate crimes against Jews and Jewish institutions, because Jews are the canary in the coal mines. If we give permission by not responding to hate crimes against Jews, then we are providing permission to go after any group. And you can see how this worked with the Armenian genocide. There were absolutely no consequences to the Armenian genocide. And that informed Hitler's decision about the final solution, because he saw you can commit genocide and nobody's going to respond. Not only that, but he very closely watched the racial policies and pseudoscience that were pervasive in the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s. And that, too, convinced him that he could wipe out Jews with impunity. Now, Mark was very quick to call out anti-Semitism, but he was very slow to accuse individuals of being anti-Semitic. And an example that I like to use is how he would have responded to the whole Ilhan Omar controversy. So he would not have jumped on the sound bites of what she said. First of all, he would have looked at everything that she said. And he would have called out bigotry, but he would not have called her a bigot. What he would have done would be to engage her publicly, and he would have used that controversy as an opportunity to build bridges. Because that's exactly what he did when Jesse Jackson made his Hymetown comments while Mark was alive. And the way he responded to that was he engaged in a program, it was called the People to People Program, with Jesse Jackson. And that then became an opportunity to affirm the solidarity between blacks and Jews rather than an opportunity to shame Jesse Jackson. He did the same thing with Jerry Falwell, who was proclaiming that America is a Christian nation. And I don't know where that leaves the rest of us who are not Christian. And so he engaged Jerry Falwell in a debate at one of the rabbinical assembly conferences, and Jerry Falwell ended up retracting that proclamation that America is a Christian nation. And in terms of Ilhan Omar's comments about Israel and whether those were anti-Semitic or whether those were legitimate criticism of government policies, he would have applied what today is called the 3D test, something that Anatol Sharansky wrote about in 2004, except that Mark was applying this test long before it came to be known by that name, namely to use three criteria to determine the point at which legitimate criticism of Israeli government policy crosses over into anti-Semitism, namely demonization, a double standard, and delegitimization. When it comes to hate speech and hate crime, the criminal justice system can only deal with the consequences of hate speech and react after it turns into a hate crime. So we really can't rely on the criminal justice system to solve that problem. It means that religious leaders have a special responsibility for calling out hate speech when it happens and cutting it off at the source. Now, religious leaders, religious actors, religious institutions bring very important things to the table when it comes to fighting hate crime. They bring moral authority, they bring vast constituencies, they bring extensive and sophisticated communication networks, they bring convening power, they bring long immersion in their communities, they can provide neutral space, and they bring EQ, or what is known today as emotional intelligence. Those are very important assets to bring to the table. And it's also very important to look at these issues through a religious lens, because 82% of the world's population identifies with a religion, and nearly 100% identify with a religion in those regions where the most atrocity crimes are taking place. Now, there's a correlation between freedom of religion and the likelihood of violence. And religion, which is so often the cause of conflict, can actually be the solution to conflict as well, provided that core religious values are engaged and mobilized. Just checking to see how we're doing with time. So using Judaism as an example, some of these values are, first of all, the idea that thou shalt not kill. But let's look at what's beneath that commandment of thou shalt not kill, because what's beneath it is one of Judaism's greatest contributions to civilization. What's beneath it is what was then a very new idea, namely the idea that every person is made in the sacred image of God and therefore inherently entitled to dignity and respect. This was a radical idea at the time that Judaism emerged among the ancient Hebrews. It's from there that one derives the basis of all human rights. And then there is Leviticus 19:16, thou shalt not stand by idly while the blood of your brother cries out from the earth. The idea that we are obligated to take action in the face of suffering. And another idea, which I mentioned earlier, the idea, and when I quoted Heschel, the idea that besmirching a person's reputation is akin to murder. Because that's where you get directly to the idea of hate speech. And then finally, the core value of Judaism, when you strip everything else away, which is the concept of tikkun olam, the obligation to repair the world. Dogmatic beliefs can separate us. But shared values can bring us together. Now, that may sound like a subtle distinction, but it's a very, very important one, the distinction between dogma and values. And Marx's take on Judaism was very much focused on shared values because he was a universalist. He wasn't a particularist. He was outward-facing, not insular, just like JTS. Is outward-facing and not insular. And what that means, being outward-facing and not insular, is being in solidarity with other human beings. So the techniques that Marx used are completely relevant for the toxic environment in which we live today. He formed multi-faith coalitions to address issues. Use them as a way of finding common cause, and in his day, Those were refugees, Soviet Jewry, civil rights, pornography. Today, it would be demonization of Muslims, the LGBTQ community, people of color, Jews, and yes, again, refugees. He would have called out the politics of purity that cause us to view the other as evil, rather than just having a different point of view. He would have debunked myths with facts by popularizing the relevant history. And he did this all the time with some of the popular TV series on which he was a consultant, such as Jesus of Nazareth and the Holocaust. Jesus of Nazareth still airs all these years later every single Easter. Henry Louis Gates probably comes the closest to that kind of thing, because Skip Gates is also a popularizer. If you look at his recent series on Reconstruction, which was an absolute eye-opener, but it was done in a way that people could access, that they could understand. Mark would have mobilized the moral authority of the clergy, and he certainly would have challenged our politicians' claims on piety if they behaved in ways that very much contradict the principles they claim to espouse. He would have appreciated the constraints and risks being taken by one's partners in dialogue or one's partners in social action. And this came across very clearly in Vatican Council II, because he understood the fine line that the Catholic Church had to tread because of the Arab countries that were threatening the Christians who lived in those countries if Vatican Council II and the historic document that came out of it, Nostra Aetate, was too nice to the Jews. And of course, we can see how very real that threat is, because today there is enormous persecution of Christians in Arab countries. In fact, Arab countries are hemorrhaging their Christian populations, and ironically, the only country in the region in which the Christian population is growing is Israel. In the work I'm doing today, Bert mentioned the Multi-Faith Alliance for Syrian Refugees. There, too, we understand that we have to recognize the risks that Syrians were taking working with Israelis and to be sensitive to that. Mark would have listened very deeply to the fears that underlie all the hate that we're seeing. And he would have spoken very powerfully to address those fears. And he would have used the media to amplify his message. His use of the media began with his work on the Eternal Light radio program. And he certainly was a genius when it came to using the media to amplify his message. He also had an ego which was well fed by all of his media exposure. So going full circle to the weaponization of language, it's very important to be able to detect the inflection points at which hate speech is about to turn into violence. And there is a great deal of research being done on this now. Certainly ADL is doing a lot of work in terms of tracking this. But as important as the need to detect hate speech is the need to deflect and debunk hate speech. And that means doing counter-messaging with all of the sophisticated tools that are employed by those who foment hate and violence, that is, using social media, high-concept videos, gaming, and others, because those tools need to be hijacked by those of us who want to replace hate with deep listening and with mutual respect. because these are the essential building blocks for achieving real connection between people. So, for a deeper dive into all of these ideas, and also for a lot more stories than the ones that I told you, the books are available back there. I hope that you'll read it. It's a very good read, a very instructive read, because the techniques and methodologies that Mark used in his time are absolutely relevant for the issues we're confronting in our time. I'm happy to take any questions, Bert. Thank you.
I'm delighted that to have Georgette here. Let's start there. And to hear her talk about what she does daily and say, Mark would have. Because yes, Mark would have, but Georgette does. And that's a very powerful thing. This book is really a litany of the kinds of things that Mark did. And as I said to Georgette earlier, it's a little depressing for someone like me who's in the field and doing all this work to realize that Mark was there 30 years before me. He paved the way on every single issue. And so if you're looking for a menu of what to do for Tikkun Olam to make the world better, you can start in a better place than this book. Even more exciting, Georgette has said that we're selling it at a discount. So the book is going to be available for sale and signed.
Jews never buy retail.
That is true. $20 in the back, Georgette will sign it if you ask politely. But right now, we have a few minutes for questions about Mark's work and maybe even about Georgette's work.
Was it something I said?
Yes, please.
No question. My future daughter. So, when you were speaking about Mark's work in the media, it really reminded me of all the changes that we see in media today. I'm curious what Mark's opinion would have been on all of the very advanced technology and on social media and the way we see a lot of hate speech in our social media channels and sort of how people are communicating with one another through these channels in a negative way. What do you think Mark's opinion would have been on that? Or what's your opinion on that?
Well, Mark would have had a goal with Twitter.
He probably would have been on Twitter constantly. But as we all know, there is a real danger to social media and the way that it's being used, because social media amplifies beyond the way that our more traditional media, the media in Mark's day, amplified messages. And unlike those traditional media, there are no checks on the information that is circulated. So you have an enormous amount of unvetted, unverified information that is weaponized. And it's what in an earlier time we would have called propaganda. And the answer to propaganda is counter-propaganda. So it's really all about messaging. And I think it's very important not to be shy about that. One has to employ very sophisticated messaging, and one has to weaponize that counter-propaganda for good causes. What gets circulated happens by going viral, and I think those of us who are trying to counter hate speech also need to go viral. We need to understand what makes for effective messaging, and what a lot of the research shows is that when you're trying to reach the general public, what's effective is storytelling. Data doesn't do any good. You use data to influence policymakers. You use stories to influence the general public. So that's a partial answer. Now, of course, there are a number of organizations, I mentioned ADL before, that track what's going on with hate speech on the internet. And that's very, very important work. The Southern Poverty Law Center is doing that. The Citizens Crime Commission of New York is doing that. This is a very, very important way to address and control this kind of messaging.
Mark Perry.
First of all, thank you so much for your remarks. Really, really good. And then I hope you'll read the book.
Thank you for listening to them. Doesn't always happen.
One of the interesting anecdotes that you brought up here was that Larry Tenenbaum was in dialogue with Jerry Falwell at the Federal Court of And I reflect on that because, quite honestly, recalling in recent years, including all of my years here at JPS and my age here, where George Weir has been in dialogue with a religious leader, a Christian religious leader from the far right. I think we've almost lost that capacity. So I'm curious to know whether there were people that Larry Tenenbaum would not dialogue with. Was there any?
Louis Farrakhan. But, you know, Mark was one of the first religious leaders, certainly Jewish religious leaders, to reach out to evangelicals. I mean, in a way, he kind of broke open that whole world, and it's a very, very important world. He had a 25-year friendship with Billy Graham, for example. And he very much appreciated Billy Graham. Are you up for some Billy Graham stories? Because so, first of all, I have to tell you that I had all of the stereotypes of Billy Graham that I think most of us New Yorkers have. You know, this is a Bible thumper, and I didn't have any use for him. Then one day, Billy Graham came to dinner. You're right, I like that. At the very least, a chapter title. Billy Graham comes to dinner. The story is in here. So Billy Graham phoned 5 minutes before he was due to arrive. I pick up the phone. He says, "Georgette, this is Billy. I'm going to be there in about 5 minutes. Okay, great. Doorbell rings. I open the door, and you know, I'm, you know, like this. I'm standing up and at my eye level, and I have to keep looking up and looking up because he's one of the tallest people who I've ever met. So he arrives with one of his daughters and her Swiss banker husband. So that immediately shattered one stereotype. And we sat down to dinner, and I had recently written a book, and one of the jacket blurbs was from Billy Graham. This was a book called The Future of Crime in America, and it had one section with about 6 chapters that dealt with what in those days we called victimless crimes, although that wasn't quite accurate, that they were victimless. So this was a chapter on pornography, prostitution, homosexuality, I don't remember what other vices. And so naturally, when we were sitting around the table, somebody brought up the subject of my book, and we ended up in this conversation about prostitution. in which Billy was a complete participant. So that got rid of another stereotype, because he was completely comfortable having conversations about this. And it's not that he started moralizing, it was a real discussion. Before dinner, he was the one doing most of the talking. He turned out to be an extraordinary raconteur, a wonderful, wonderful conversationalist. And I learned that every one of his children had lived in a kibbutz in Israel. He sent all of his children to live in a kibbutz. And being good evangelical Christians, there were a good number of children. Other stories that are not well known. Every time he would do a crusade in a communist country, he would always call Mark and say, "Mark, what can I do for the Jews while I'm there?" And another relatively unknown story is that Billy Graham probably saved the state of Israel. And here's how he saved it. During the 73 war, Golda Meir was desperately trying to get an airlift from the U.S. As you know, Israel was completely unprepared for that attack. And Richard Nixon was not responding. Mark called Billy Graham. Billy Graham called Nixon. The next day, the airlift went to Israel. So when years later, the Nixon tapes revealed this conversation that Billy Graham and Nixon had in the Oval Office with all this ugly anti-Semitic stuff on both their sides, there was not a single Jew or Jewish organization that came to Billy Graham's defense. And I felt that I had to, because whatever went on in that office, those words did not reflect Billy Graham's actions, because Billy Graham was actually one of the greatest friends to the Jewish community. And even if he meant all that stuff, I think that one has to respond from where Billy Graham was as an evangelical Christian. Now, one of the core beliefs in evangelical Christianity is that no man can fall so far or so often as to not be redeemed in Christ. So even if Billy Graham did in fact fall and fail in that conversation in the Oval Office, and who knows, maybe he felt compelled to go along with Richard Nixon, doesn't matter to me. What matters is he more than redeemed himself in terms of all of the actions that he took on behalf of the Jews. And by the way, that also included his pledge not to try to convert Jews in the key campaigns that he ran. Jews were excluded from those conversion efforts. So that, the point I'm making in this very long-winded way, is how important the outreach to the evangelical community is. And just to kind of bring this to the present, we, as Jews, really need to not take for granted the support of the evangelical community of Israel, because the younger generation of evangelicals does not have the same commitment to Israel that the older generation had. Those
that's also true of the younger generation of Jews.
That's right.
We have time for one more question.
Both the stories that you're telling and what I know Rabbi Kendall's work in your own work, it seems like the role of relationship is really essential. And I'm curious just to hear more about your thoughts of the role of anonymity in hate speech, especially online, but also in the public sphere, that people are able to hide behind either a mask or the illusion of being anonymous in an online forum, and how that, your understanding, is contributing to the way that hate speech is functioning.
Oh, that's a very interesting question, and not one to which I've given a lot of thought, but obviously, if you can hide behind anonymity, it becomes so much easier to indulge in this stuff. And in a way, it reminds me of, I'm a sociologist by training and by degree, and it reminds me of one of the problems with doing survey research, which is the bias from the social desirability response. So when you are doing an in-person interview and you're not anonymous, the social desirability response tends to kick in, and you're going to be a lot more honest about your responses when you're not identified in a survey. So I see those as actually being parallel. But what the answer to it is, I can't do that one just off the top of my head, but I think it's important that you raise that question, because that certainly is a real enabler. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you again, Georgette. There are plenty of copies of the book. There are more than is right out there on the table. And I want to encourage you to get copies, give them as Halloween gifts, bring them to Thanksgiving banquets. Hanukkah's coming up. Anyone you give this book to will be grateful.
And
because
Christmas also.
Yes, Christmas.
Tannenbaum means Christmas tree in German.
Yes. So thank you again.